Hello there and welcome. Today is Tuesday, March 12th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Ethiopia and other countries are grounding the Boeing 737 MAX 8 jetliner after a catastrophic crash on Sunday.
This does not mean that the incident was related with defects on this specific fleet, but we have taken this as an extra safety precaution.
Refugee camps in Syria with mostly women and children are becoming increasingly dangerous. Algeria's president bows to pressure not to run for a fifth term. It's all on today's International Edition. As families mourn the 157 victims of the Ethiopian Airlines plane that went down in clear weather shortly after takeoff Sunday, investigators say they found the jetliner's two flight recorders at the crash site outside the capital of Addis Ababa. One of them is reported to be partially damaged. People from 35 countries died in the crash 6 minutes after takeoff from Ethiopia's capital en route to Nairobi. Ethiopian Airlines said the senior pilot issued a distress call and was told to return, but all contact was lost shortly afterward. At least 21 staff members from the United Nations were also killed in the crash. UN spokesman Stéphane Dujarric.
The UN Secretary General, Mr. Antonio Guterres, has sent out a poignant message of condolences to everybody, not just the UN staff, the crew of the flight, all other nationalities which are on the plane. Every person that lost his or her life has a loved one left behind who will be mourning this loss forever.
Airlines in Ethiopia, China, Indonesia, and elsewhere grounded the Boeing 737 MAX 8 jetliner Monday after the second devastating crash of one of the planes in 5 months. Ethiopian Airlines said it's just out of abundance of caution.
We have grounded all Boeing B737-8 MAX fleet, which Ethiopian Airlines was operating and which was involved in yesterday's accident, as a precaution safety measure.
Boeing said it had no reason to pull the popular aircraft from the skies. Safety experts cautioned against drawing too many comparisons between the two crashes until more is known. A witness said that smoke was coming from the rear of the plane before it hit the ground. Ethiopian authorities are leading the investigation into the crash, assisted by the U.S., Kenya, and others. It was similar to that of the Lion Air jet of the same model in Indonesian seas last year, killing 189 people. A preliminary investigation of the accident said the automatic safety system repeatedly pushed the plane's nose downward despite the pilot's attempts to maintain control. Pilots say Boeing didn't inform pilots about any changes to the safety system. Captain Dennis Tajeris flies with American Airlines and is a spokesman for the Allied Pilots Association, the Airlines Union. He tells my colleague Kate Pound Dawson that pilots are now prepared for problems, but still want more information on the latest accident.
After the Lion Air tragedy, there was a real shake in trust. Boeing had not disclosed information about a system that actually triggered during that crash. And was part of the reason that the aircraft crashed. Wasn't even in our flight manual. They actually said they chose to not disclose that in the pilot flight manual. Our company was in the dark as much as we were, American Airlines, and they provided us the information as it came to us from Boeing through and the FAA put out an emergency airworthiness directive. So all that information was placed in our books. We were trained via ground school on that new system. And we were comfortable with knowing that system and how to intervene when it goes awry based on bad information that it was receiving in the Lion Air crash. And now today we have this incident, which it's very, very early, and we're not jumping to conclusions, but it happened in a similar flight regime as the Lion Air and had some behavior characteristics that looked similar to us. But we're not drawing any conclusions. But what our pilots are asking out on the line, and I'm a 737 captain, we're looking across the cockpit and say, okay, let's make sure we're watching this thing. And we're maintaining the margin of safety. We feel like we're prepared, but we also have to be, we're human beings, so we're dealing with the not too many months ago loss of trust that we had with Boeing that had been repaired. But this incident, it's just natural for us to say, okay, let's keep our wits about us and get all the information here. So it's safe to fly in that aircraft. Our men and women are doing it right now with many of our families on board. We also are very disciplined in making sure that we're the advocate for our passengers. We're a stakeholder in this, but we're also the voice of our passengers when it comes to safety. We're on that airplane with them, and we take that calling and that mission very seriously.
I think that many passengers are a little bit more surprised, I think, than pilots are at how much computerization there is in the cockpit these days. Why we would be surprised, I don't know, given how much computerization there is in everything else in our lives. But when Lion Air took place, I think people were surprised. Wait, their data could go wrong in aircraft. Surprised people and startled passengers. Did it also startle pilots when you found out?
Well, certainly if we find out that there was some technology in the aircraft that would automatically trigger and we didn't even know it existed, that was outrageous to us, unacceptable. We got that information, and now we know what to do when that technology goes awry. Technology is a great enhancement to safety, but if it's your sole dependency of safety and a margin of safety, then you have a diseased philosophy. So it's an assistant to it, but the real nuts and bolts of flying come with stick and rudder, and that's the pilots that are up there who fly the aircraft. And when technology needs to be taken out of the loop because it's run awry, the pilots are the ones that will bring that aircraft back safely. And that's something that will never change. Sometimes manufacturers want to rely on technology for lower experience level in pilots across the globe. And that's fine to have it as an enhancement. But to have it as a replacement for experience is wrong. And it will not be successful. And we're seeing pushback on that right now. So we embrace technology, but as an assistant to the safety margin, not as the foundational element of it. We are that element, and we're on the airplane, and we're going to protect our passengers with our professional pilot skills, not just our IT skills.
That was Pilot Dennis Tajir with the Allied Pilots Association speaking with VOA's Kate Pound-Dawson. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. The U.S. says there will be no phased approach to North Korea denuclearization. U.S. sanctions bank jointly owned by Russia and Venezuela. Hong Kong is at the center of wildlife trafficking. And free books inspire love of reading. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. U.S. President Donald Trump is proposing a record $4.75 billion federal budget for the 2020 fiscal year. Some leaders in Congress, which controls the purse strings, are declaring the wish list dead on arrival. More from VOA's White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman.
One budget item Democrats who control the House of Representatives say they will fiercely oppose is billions of more dollars for construction of a wall along the U.S. border with Mexico. At the White House lectern on Monday, acting director of the Office of Management and Budget, Russ Vogt, defended the request.
This $8.6 billion is geared towards what we would need in addition to complete that wall.
The budget boosts defense spending by nearly 5%. More money than even the Pentagon requested, while slashing nearly one-fourth of the State Department's funding. Steve Herman, VOA News, at the White House.
As internationally backed Syrian forces continue what they believe will be their final battle for Islamic State-controlled territory, more than 65,000 people, mostly women and children, have fled to camps in northern Syria. No one expected or planned for the massive number of people. And many of those who've been displaced remain defiant, vowing that ISIS will rise again. VOA's Heather Murdoch reports from Al-Hol camp in northern Syria that conditions in the camp are becoming increasingly more dangerous and may actually only add fuel to the fire of their rage.
Several families crowd into this dirty tent, and many of the children are sick. In recent days, at least 100 people have died either traveling to the camp or when they arrived. Almost all were children. Besides a deadly health crisis, thousands of tents are needed to shelter new arrivals. There are no adult men to be seen among camp residents, and most of the people are somehow related to IS. Many are their wives, widows, or children, and many have not lost their faith in the group. Umm Mohammed was married to an IS fighter. She says she believes IS was right to kill their enemies, and she hopes her five children will grow up to be IS fighters like their father. A 12-year-old boy at the camp, named Mohammed, sells vegetables out of crates with his friends to make money. He says he came here from Baghouz, the last Islamic State stronghold, with his family after retreating with the militant group several times through several towns and cities. He said he's not sure if the camp is safe because he sees IS as their protectors. At another temporary camp near the battle zone, aid workers unload bottles of water from a truck, preparing for more exhausted, sick, and starving people to arrive on their way to the camp. The aid workers say the only way they know to counter the widespread extremism is to provide humanitarian aid and prove they are not the enemy. But aid organizations say the Al-Hol camp is at a breaking point, and future concerns have to wait while they try to deal with the current crisis. Mazen Sheikha is a camp official.
We are in the emergency situation right now, as you see, because we have a lot of people come from a lot of parts which was under control from ISIS, and we have a lot of needs.
Thousands of foreign family members of IS fighters are kept separately, with many waiting to hear if their countries of origin will take them back. The future for Syrian and Iraqi families is also not clear. IS retreated for years as they were pushed out of cities and towns. The families are now far from home and may be rejected by their communities if or when they try to return. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Al-Hol Camp, Syria.
Algerian President Abdelaziz Bouteflika bowed to unprecedented public protests Monday and promised not to seek a fifth term after 20 years in power. In a letter to the nation released by state news agency APS, the ailing leader also said the presidential election scheduled for April 18th would be postponed. He promised to establish a panel to plan a rescheduled vote. Bouteflika, who is 82, has barely been seen in public since a 2013 stroke. His decision to run again set off protests in February and have expanded to include broader complaints about corruption and heavy-handed security policies. But celebrations popped up instead of protests on the street of the capital, Algiers, at the news that he had dropped his re-election bid. Car horns rang out while people waved Algerian flags and sang the national anthem. Joining us to discuss is Bill Fisher, former Australian ambassador to Algeria. Thank you for being with us, sir. Are you surprised that he reversed course and said he won't seek another term?
Over the last few days, it's become clear that the demonstrations have had a really impressive effect on le pouvoir. Algeria is run not really by an individual like Bouteflika, but by a rather shadowy, in fact, very shadowy group of people who are generally known as le pouvoir. And over the last few days, a number of essential things have gone wrong for them. For example, 1,000 judges have said they won't supervise the elections. Then some people in the senior ranks of the army, which is most significant, have indicated that things must change. I think it's become clear to the various participants in Le Pouvoir that the game has got to change. That doesn't mean that Bouteflika was necessarily going too quickly, because, as you know, the decision has been that they will not hold the elections as scheduled in a few days, and that means that he stays in power for an indeterminate period. He's calling a constitutional type convention. This is a new thing in Algeria. Heaven knows what that might mean and who'd be in it and how it'd be run. So that could be a process of weeks, months, years, and who knows about that. It can be done. Next door in Tunisia they did it after the fall of Ben Bella, and you know, the process was very efficiently run by the Tunisians. So it's, you know, it's not impossible that a fairly rapid new constitution can be drafted, but I think it's not very likely that that would happen. And in the meantime, the situation continues sort of bubbling along without any immediate resolution for an indeterminate period, with Bouteflika at least nominally in position. But don't forget, he's been, you know, sort of out of sight, out of play now for about 5 years. I don't think he's been seen in public since about 2013. And whether he actually participates in day-to-day government, who knows? It's such an obscure regime that nobody knows what's happening inside it.
And if he were, in fact, to do as he says he's going to do, which is to withdraw from a bid for another term in office, there would be no guarantee that the person that does ultimately take his place would be the sort of leader that these protesters are looking for.
There are hundreds of thousands of protesters, and nobody could guess at what sort of person they're looking for. And in a way, that doesn't matter, because firstly, who knows what sort of regime will emerge after this constitutional convention, and as I said earlier, however long that might take. And secondly, the ruling power group, what is called le pouvoir in Algiers, will still hold the power, and so whoever they put up will presumably get elected within a... That's not to say that they will put up just one person. No, there may be some sort of choice, but it will be very much a continuation of the type of regime that Algeria has always known. I just don't see really the possibility of anything like a new and open regime taking its place. It, as I said, Bouteflika doesn't really matter so much anymore because he's been out of it for so long. So now, you know, we'll have the various components of the ruling group, which is, you know, certain generals, the intelligence services, a few big businessmen, and not to forget the Return Servicemen's organization. That group of 40 people, perhaps, that's the ruling group in Algiers, and it will be for many years.
Why is Algeria important to the world? Why should people around the world care about it?
Algeria is a very big hitter internationally because of the role it's played in the sort of general anti-colonial struggles. Now, the war for independence in Algeria was one of the most dramatic and brutal, and sort of that has carried the regime through very difficult periods internationally. It has a lot of credibility in the what we now call the developing countries, and also because, frankly, its personnel have been particularly competent. If you go to the United Nations for almost any resolution, the Algerian delegation is one of those first consulted, because they are power wielders within the group of developing countries. Because they're tough, they do not come around easily to resolutions until they get at least part of their own way. And I admire their foreign service. It's one of the most competent in the world.
All right. That is Bill Fisher, former Australian ambassador to Algeria. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
The 2019 VOA calendars are in. This year's calendar features a variety of scenic photos that capture U.S. byways, including beautiful photos of the Big Sur Coast Highway and even the historic Route 66. Tune in to Border Crossings at 1500 Universal to request a free calendar.
VOA's International Edition continues. Environmental groups are celebrating efforts to ban what they say is an avalanche of plastic straws polluting the world's oceans. Chain restaurants like Starbucks and McDonald's are phasing out plastics, and U.S. cities like Seattle have banned them entirely. There are billions of straws in the ocean already. But a group of volunteer trash collectors in Australia is trying to at least clean up a local cove. VOA's Kevin Enix reports.
These volunteer divers are snorkel fishing in Manly Cove in Sydney, Australia. But they're not looking for fish. They're diving for plastic. All kinds of plastic, but mainly straws. It's part of a volunteer effort to clean the cove, called Operation Straw.
So when we started this project, we actually just genuinely wanted to count how many straws and other plastic items we were finding in the ocean. So I was really surprised at how many people wanted to join in. And I think it's because it's such a feel-good activity to be able to get in and do something about the problems facing the world.
Harriet Spark founded Operation Straw when she came across this octopus in the cove clutching plastic straws.
We actually once found an octopus. So there's lots of octopus in this bay. It's full of beautiful marine life. And we found an octopus holding plastic straws in its tentacles, and we actually had to pull them out. So that was a bit of a depressing tug of war.
The group volunteers their Saturdays to dive in the cove and pick up trash.
I found 23 today, which is not my record. My record is up in the 60s, but it was a pretty good hit.
The effort has inspired 40 local businesses to do their part by ending their use of plastic straws.
Hugo's situated down here on the water, and Operation Straw is in effect, and they're collecting straws all the time down here, and we know that we're one of the restaurants not supplying those straws.
During Operation Straw's initial summer of work in 2018, the team pulled over 2,000 straws out of Manly Cove. To put that in perspective, Australians use 2.9 billion straws a year.
Oh, you can see the change. There's far fewer plastic straws there now. Bait bags, plastic food packaging, everything else just as bad. But it shows that you can make a difference by implementing change.
Every little bit helps. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
Here in the United States, while medications are required to be studied and approved for safety, the same does not hold true for vitamins and other natural supplements and natural health products. Things are a bit different in some other Western countries, particularly in Canada. Joining us to talk about why it could matter is naturopathic doctor Nirat Nibber with the Crescent Health Clinic and medical advisor for AOR, one of the Canadian firms testing products using more stringent standards. Thank you for being with us. So first, what specifically does AOR do?
So I think that we're at a great point in the United States of being able to introduce regulation. And I think it's the right time because things are really burgeoning, if you will. So we here in Canada have had these regulatory requirements in place since the early 2000s. And for us, we find that it's actually quite helpful for a number of reasons, primarily because you do get a second pair of eyes or a second group or administrator to really ensure that everyone is doing their due diligence. And ultimately, it's about ensuring companies are being held accountable. So while, you know, some nutraceutical companies, as leaders, it behooves us to make sure that our supplements are of the highest quality and we're being as transparent, it's unfortunate that that standard isn't held across the industry. So for a company such as ourselves, we find this incredibly valuable to bring in some sort of regulation and a regulatory body.
The supplements in Canada are put under, what I'm hearing, much more stringent standards. Would they be somewhat equal with medication there?
I wouldn't say that they're comparable, and I think for good reason, because one, our access to the literature on a lot of these supplements shouldn't be held to the same standard or rigor of the pharmaceutical medications, because just by virtue of the certain mechanisms of action. However, what is happening is that when we are making claims, very specific health claims, for example, this improves egg quality in women. To say a specific claim like that, we have to provide evidence. And that evidence can range from clinician evidence, so insight into historical use. There has to be some written account of it, and also there has to be human randomized controlled trials. Now, to make these claims, it also allows us to treat. Where I think there needs to be some more support and growth is providing that research and that evidence. Because as you may know, there hasn't been as much inclination by researchers in the past to invest in this kind of research. I think that's changing for the most part.
Why is it important to have higher standards for natural and supplemental products as compared to not having any sort of degree of scrutiny?
So I believe that ultimately you're influencing people's health. And to do that, you're changing people's physiologic mechanisms. So to do that, you need to be confident and comfortable that A, what they're putting in is into their bodies is what they think it is, that they have appropriate expectations of what it will do in their bodies, and that the company has done its due diligence in making sure that they're clean and if it needs to be ethically sourced or whatever it is, whatever they're advertising is in fact true. So with supplements, why is it more important than anything else? It's because we're actually influencing people's health. Otherwise, why would we take them, right?
All right. Well, that's naturopathic Dr. Nirant Nibber with the Crescent Health Clinic. Thanks for being with us. She was born Sheila Cecilia Escovedo, but is known for her stage name Sheila E. She was one of the top female musicians in the 1980s, thanks to her catchy Latin rhythms and uniquely powerful drumming style. Her debut album, released in 1984, and the title track single, The Glamorous Life, became her career-defining song, peaking at number 7 on the Hot 100 and topping the dance charts for 2 weeks in August that same year. The video for the song garnered 3 MTV Music Award nominations for Best Female Video, Best New Artist, and Best Choreography. And she also received 2 Grammy nominations for Best New Artist and Best Pop Vocal Performance Female. In the early days of her career, the late singer Prince became a mentor of sorts. They met at a concert where she was performing with her father and later went on to contribute to vocals on Prince's B-side to his wildly popular song Let's Go Crazy. She also toured as the opening act for Prince's Purple Rain tour. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day. Thank you.
This is VOA News.